Welcome to Back to Basics with Pastor Brian Broderson, an outreach ministry of Calvary Chapel, Costa Mesa, California. This program is designed to take you back to basic principles for living found in the Word of God.
So hey everybody, turn up your radio. Listen to your soul cry the question why song makes you wonderful. Something you never seen before.
Pastor Brian is currently teaching through the book of Revelation, and we'll be continuing today with part one of Worthy is the Lamb. So let's turn in our Bibles to Revelation chapter 5, verse 8, as Pastor Brian takes us back to basics.
These chapters, chapters 4 and 5 in particular, the heavenly scene there, I would imagine that everyone who's ever sought to teach them has felt the way I do. You just feel totally inadequate for the task. You just feel like, how can you do justice to this? And you know, you kind of understand a little bit more about what Paul meant when he said that he saw things in heaven that it would be unlawful for a man to try to describe. And even though God has given us a picture here, he's revealed to us what is going to transpire when we arrive in heaven. And there he is seated upon the throne, and the living creatures and the elders, and then the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Lamb that was slain, as we've already looked at, as Jesus comes forth and takes this scroll. You know, how can we at this point even grasp the glory of that? I don't know. I wish I could somehow communicate it in a way that would grip us to the extent that we will be moved when we're actually there. But, you know, I was thinking about kind of that climactic moment in the Lord of the Rings trilogy, where, you know, the story and just all of that whole struggle to actually destroy the ring that was really causing all of the havoc and all of the trouble in their world, and how just at, you know, that final moment, if you saw those films and if you saw the last one, that final moment where Frodo has finally come to the place where he's about to throw the ring back in and have it destroyed, and as a result of that, you know, all of the evil that's overtaken those worlds is going to be done away with forever. But there's this battle that's going on there, and everything goes into slow motion. And because he starts to sort of change his mind about it, they were having victory, but then for just a few moments there, they start to go into the mode of defeat. And then, you know, all of these things happen, but finally the ring is thrown back in to the fires of Mordor, and all of the evil is just consumed in a moment's time. And it's just this moment of power and this moment of glory. And, you know, I don't really want to, you know, make the connection with what we're talking about here in any kind of a full sense, but you know, just trying to get a visual, just trying to get an emotional connection with it. But you know, with Jesus here, in a sense, there is a parallel, because what's happening here is this moment when, remember, God is sitting on the throne with a scroll in his hand, and the question is, who is worthy to take the scroll and to open its seals, and there's no one at all who's found worthy. And basically, the idea there is that the one who takes the scroll is going to redeem the world, and the thought that there's no redemption for the world, that the world has to go on in this state of misery and destruction, is so overwhelming that John finds himself sobbing convulsively. And it's at that moment that the angel speaks and says, "Do not weep. Behold, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David. He has prevailed to take the scroll and to loose the seals." And what's happening here is, in a sense, it's a repossession. You see, God created the world, and as we talked about previously, he created the world and he gave it over to man. But when man rebelled against God, he lost control of the world, and Satan became the ruler of the world. And that is what the Bible teaches. That isn't theory. That isn't, you know, some sort of fantastical view of things. That's what the scriptures teach. Satan is referred to as the ruler of this world, the god of this age, the prince of the power of the air. All of these things indicate that he is the one who has been in control since man forfeited his position of ruling over this planet. And because Satan is the one that has been in control, and man has been submitted to the authority of Satan, we have a history. Our history is one of death and destruction and misery and pain and sorrow, and it's endless from beginning to where we are presently. And, you know, the more you know about history, the more you realize that nothing ever really changes. It's the same kinds of scenarios over and over and over again, and it's basically war, it's basically misery, it's basically death, it's destruction, and, you know, there's occasionally a little pocket of relief here and there for maybe a certain group of people, but for the most part, it's a history of woe and grief and tragedy. That is the history of mankind, because man has rejected God's rule and man has submitted himself to Satan and to sin, and thus we have the experiences that we've had. But there's coming a time, and this is the scene that we have arrived at here, where God is going to take control of the world back. And basically what's being described here is the repossession of the earth by God himself through his son, Jesus. And that's what's happening here. The Lion of the tribe of Judah, he has prevailed to take the scroll and to loose the seals. And so this is that moment where everybody, that moment of just total suspense in one sense, there's no one who's worthy. But then that moment when they see the Lamb that was slain in the midst of the throne as he comes forth, and now you can just imagine what it's going to be like as everyone is there gathered around and watching this process as he takes the scroll from the hand of the Father. And this is the beginning of the end of man's reign, of Satan's reign, of death and destruction and misery. This is the beginning of the end of it. And so all heaven breaks forth into this chorus. And that's where we pick up in verse 8. "Now when he had taken the scroll, the four living creatures and the 24 elders fell down before the Lamb, each having a harp and golden bowls full of incense, which are the prayers of the saints." What is the prayer that all of the saints have prayed since the time of Christ? The prayer that he taught us. You remember the first part of that? Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be your name. Your kingdom come, your will be done. And all of those prayers that have been lifted up by God's people over all of these long centuries, the essence of those prayers being, Lord, your will, bring your kingdom come, your will be done. And now all of those prayers are being brought to their fruition. They're about to be answered. You know, sometimes it seems like we pray and pray and pray and not a whole lot happens. Isn't that true? You know, you can pray for someone or you can pray about something and you pray and pray and it just doesn't seem like anything changes. Seems like it all just kind of goes on as it is. And think of all of the saints back to the time of Christ, and we could even go back further if we wanted to. All of the people of God that have prayed these prayers, the essence of the prayer being, thy kingdom come, thy will be done. There's coming a day when that prayer will be answered. And that is, again, what we're reading about here. And so they burst forth into song, and they sing a new song. You are worthy to take the scroll and to open its seals, for you were slain and have redeemed us to God by your blood. Now remember, some time ago I talked about how the book of Revelation in many ways bears strong resemblance to the Old Testament prophets. In some ways, the book of Revelation seems almost more Old Testament than New Testament. Obviously, it is New Testament. But as you read it, you see that here in Revelation, it's like all of the pieces come together finally. And all of those things going all the way back to the garden, all the way back to those early chapters of Genesis, and then all of those prophecies that were given throughout all of those centuries, it all comes to its climactic point here in this book. And here we see again that connection. And it's in these words, for you were slain and have redeemed us to God by your blood. You see, these ideas of redemption, of sacrificing of a life, of the shedding of blood for atonement, these are ideas that are rooted deeply in the scriptures of the Old Testament. You know, some people mistakenly think that the Old Testament is old in the sense that it's irrelevant. It's, you know, no longer applicable. Why bother with it? You know, we've got the New Testament. What do we need the Old Testament for? Well, you see, the Old Testament is the foundation for everything that ultimately comes forth in the New Testament. And we would do ourselves a tremendous favor, and we will find great blessing if we meditate on, study, and come to understand the Old Testament. The more we understand the Old Testament, the better we will understand the New Testament. And we will find that there are all of these correlations, there are these pictures, there are these connecting rituals and things that they don't seem to make sense sometimes if you just read them out of the context of the Old Testament. But when you understand the connection, it gives you a better picture. And this whole idea of redemption, this idea of redemption is firmly rooted in the Old Testament. Israel, of course, was given a land. They were given the land of Canaan. It was given to Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and their descendants. We know that land today as the land of Israel. Some people insist on calling it Palestine, and I don't understand that. That was the name given to it by the Romans after they destroyed Jerusalem, and it was a name that went back to the Philistine period. It's the land of Israel. And that land was given to God's people by tribe, and it was given then, divided up within the tribes, it was given to families. And God built something interesting into their system, and it was that their land would never be permanently taken away from them on the level of the family. And even if a person, through some difficulty, some, you know, financial disaster or whatever it might have been, even if they lost their property, there was always an opportunity for redemption. There was an opportunity for the property to be purchased back for the family. And then there was also every 50 years what was called the Year of Jubilee. And in the Year of Jubilee, everybody's land went back to the original owner. So God built this into their governmental and societal system. The book of Ruth gives a beautiful story about this whole idea of redemption. And it's the story of a Jewish family who left their land in Bethlehem and went to Moab. And there in Moab, the husband and the two sons died. The two sons married while they were in Moab. And Naomi, the wife of Elimelech, the man who died, decided at a point to return to her native land, to Bethlehem. And so when she decided to leave Moab and go back, she relieved her daughter-in-laws, whose husbands had passed away. She relieved them of any responsibility, said, you know, you stay here with your people. I'm going to go back to my people. One of them agreed that that was probably the best. The other one, Ruth, said, no, I'm going to go with you. And so Naomi agreed, and Ruth went back with her. And when they came back, they found that things were difficult, and they didn't have the property that they had left behind. And so they were living in poverty. But there was a man named Boaz who was a close relative of Elimelech, the man who had died. And he was a very wealthy man. And he had lots of fields and lots of crops and things. So Naomi encouraged Ruth to go out and to, you know, glean in those fields, to pick up the leftover crops from the day's harvesting. And that's what they were living on. And this man, Boaz, takes note of this girl. She was obviously very beautiful. And he starts to bless her sort of indirectly. He tells his field workers, he says, you know, when she comes, you know, kind of throw a little bit of extra grain her way or whatever it was. And, you know, so he starts instructing that way. But then as Naomi discovers that Boaz is starting to sort of take a little bit of interest there, Naomi says to Ruth, she says, now Boaz, he is a close relative, and he is the Goel. And the Hebrew word Goel means he is the redeemer. He is the close relative. You see, if you lost your property, it could be redeemed, but it had to be redeemed by a close relative. And there were all different kinds of circumstances surrounding that, but there was a time of redemption that would come up, and you would have to have this close relative to be there and to willingly become the Goel, to willingly become the redeemer. And so as the story goes on, Boaz falls in love with Ruth, and she is, you know, wanting to commit herself to him. But there's another closer relative who actually has the first right of redemption if he should choose it. And so Boaz undertakes to get the redemption of the property for Naomi and Ruth. So he goes to the closer relative and says, Elimelech's property has come up for redemption, and you're the closest relative. Do you want to redeem it? And the guy says, yeah, sounds great. I'll redeem it. And he says, there's one catch. Ruth, the Moabitess, she goes with it, and you would have to marry her, and you would have to raise up a son for Elimelech's family from Ruth. And so the man says, I can't do that. He wanted the land, but he didn't want the bride. And so he said to Boaz, he says, why don't you redeem it? And Boaz said, yes, okay, he agreed. And they had this particular ceremony that they went through where they took off a sandal and handed the sandal to the person, and that was the way that this whole redemptive thing took place. But here's the thing. The Goel was known as the kinsman redeemer. Had to be a close relative in order to redeem. Now, the world was created by God, owned by God, but the world, like the land of Israel, the rightful ownership that God had given it over to man was forfeited to the enemy, to Satan. But the right of redemption comes up. And so what happens? The Son of God becomes a close relative. He takes upon himself human nature. He becomes one of us in order that he can redeem the world. And the interesting thing about the Ruth story is that really, if you look at it technically, Boaz was a wealthy man. He was a man who had lots of land already. The land issue wasn't so much the point. It was the bride. He wanted the bride. And so it is true with Christ. It's not so much the world that Jesus was primarily interested in, the soil. Of course, the Lord could make that any time. But it was the bride. It was the people, those that he loved. And this picture that we're seeing painted for us of these events that will transpire in heaven, they're connected back to those things in the Old Testament. And so as the song breaks forth that you have redeemed us to God, it's what God had been revealing all the way throughout history. His plan has now finally come to fruition. It's come to its climactic point. And now all of those many, that's just one, all of those many different pictures that were given back in the Old Testament are now being fulfilled at this moment. But notice, you have redeemed us. Here's another picture, by your blood. Of course, in the kinsman redeemer situation, there was no bloodshed. There was nothing like that that occurred. But here we see that Jesus redeemed us by his blood. And of course, all through the Old Testament, and especially in the sacrifices, you find this element of blood, but you find specifically stated in Leviticus that without the shedding of blood, there is no remission for sins. For it is blood that makes atonement for the soul, and the life of the flesh is in the blood. So you see, this idea that Jesus would shed his blood in order to redeem us, this is an idea that is so deeply rooted in God's institutions that he established among his ancient people, Israel. It was so deeply rooted in their whole culture and their whole life's experience, so that when Christ came and when these things transpired, that people would make that connection, that they would see the fulfillment. You know, one of the biggest mistakes that we can make as Christians is to forget the connection between what Jesus did and the previous history, and especially all of the prophecies about what he would come and do. You know, sometimes Christians speak about Jesus in a way that sort of presents him as a person who just happens to show up approximately 2,000 years ago, just sort of out of nowhere, And, you know, he's making claims that nobody else claimed and so on. That's not the best way to present Christ. We need to present him in the context of history.
We'll return with more of our study through the book of Revelation in our next lesson as Pastor Brian continues with part two of Worthy is the Lamb. But right now I'd like to remind you that if you missed any part of this study, or perhaps you'd like to review it again at a more convenient time, you can do so by simply calling us toll-free at 1-800-733-6443 and request the message entitled Worthy is the Lamb. Or if you prefer, simply refer to it by resource number BT-3277. Once again, our toll-free number is 1-800-733-6443. And for those of you that prefer to write, you can address your correspondence to Back to Basics, P.O. Box 8000, Costa Mesa, California, 92628. And when writing or calling, be sure to ask for a free catalog of available resources from Back to Basics, and please include the call letters of this station with your correspondence. You're also invited to visit our website at backtobasicsradio.com, where you can listen to archived messages by Pastor Brian or subscribe to our podcasts. Once again, that's backtobasicsradio.com.
Turn up your radio.
Back to Basics is sponsored by Calvary Chapel of Costa Mesa, California.